Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 27, Valor of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Andy Clements, Christopher Sheeran, Eric Messner, Joe Brack, Thomas Penny, Christopher Graybill, Elizabeth Jernigan, Ken Jackson, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Terrence Asenford, Scott McCormick, James Konacek, Drew Kopas, Tim Getman, Michael John Casey, Tim Carlin, and Nanette Savard.
The Territorial Prison was an adobe brick building that stood in the middle of 180 acres between 14th East and 21st South in the town of Sugar House in the Utah Territory. Though built to house less than 200 men, it was already crammed to the breaking point with some of the meanest men west of the Mississippi. From footpads to rapists to bank robbers to murderers, sooner or later, they all ended up here. In cell house number one, over 30 men slept on cots in corridors between the cells, eating their meals in three shifts and using buckets for privies since the toilet facilities were so primitive. The place was barely tolerable in the heat of summer, but now that the fall was upon the region and the nighttime temperatures often fell into the 20s, the situation was almost unbearable. One of the hardest men in the group of very hard men indeed, Ozark Jack Berlin, leaned over the bucket full of piss and crap and spat out his food. He was a big man, standing 3 inches over 6 feet, with muscular shoulders as broad as an axe handle. His face was rough-featured, set under a full head of unruly black hair, with a nose that had been broken more than once and lips that were thin and cruel.
"This stuff ain't fit for man or beast."
He was talking to the half-breed Modoc Indian sitting on a cot next to his. The Indian had long black hair hanging down over his ears to his collar, and his reddish-bronze skin framed a hooked nose over full lips that was constantly licking. Blue Owl looked up from his plate, which was empty except for a small piece of biscuit he was using to sop up the gravy from the maggot-riddled horse meat.
"If you know what you are, shove it over here. It's better than buffalo meat any day."
Berlin handed Blue Owl his plate.
"I tell you, Blue Owl, I think it's about time to bust out of this joint."
Blue Owl didn't answer, being busy shoving Berlin's food into his mouth. But he cut his eyes to the side and nodded his agreement.
"I got me an idea how we can do it. Today's payday for the guards. I figured they'll all head for town as soon as they get their money to spend it on whores and whiskey."
Blue Owl nodded again, his Adam's apple bobbing as he swallowed.
"That'll only leave one man in cell house one and a couple more in the other parts of the building. If we can get our hands on the guard's gun, we can break into the armory and steal us some more weapons, take over the rest of the prison."
"Then what, Jack? We gonna walk all the way to Salt Lake City?"
"Nah, we'll just take the guard's horses and the supply wagons they keep round back and head toward Colorado. There's plenty of sod busters and farmers between here and there. We'll just take what we need along the way."
"Sounds all right to me. Anyway, you'll be sitting here and waiting to be hung."
After the evening meal, prison guard Joe Johnson moved through the cell block, picking up plates and tin cups from the inmates. Following protocol set up by the warden, he wore no weapon while in the company of the criminals he was working with. He was watched by guard Billy Thornton, who was standing outside the bars of the cell block, a .44 Colt in a holster on his hip, and an American Arms 12-gauge shotgun cradled in his arms. It was a ritual they'd played out countless times, and Thornton was bored. As Joe Johnson leaned down to take Berlin's plate from him, Berlin glanced over his shoulder and saw Thornton leaning against the wall with his eyes closed. Quick as a flash, Berlin grabbed the back of Johnson's head and hit him in the throat with his closed fist.
Hey, Billy, something's wrong with Joe. He's choking.
Thornton came to attention, looked into the cell block, and saw his friend Joe on his knees, his face blue and his mouth open and gasping as he jerked wide eyes back and forth. Thornton ran to Joe's side and went down on one knee to see if he could help. Blue Owl stepped up behind Thornton, put his hands together, and swung them like a club into the back of Thornton's neck. Berlin grabbed the shotgun before it could hit the dirt floor of the cell, and Blue Owl slipped the .44 Colt from Thornton's holster as he fell face down on the ground. Berlin ran toward the cell door.
Grab them keys, boys. We're getting out of here.
Sam Cook, in prison for raping and killing two women, took the keys off the unconscious Thornton's belt and followed Berlin and Blue Owl through the door. Behind him, the other 30 men in the cell block scrambled to their feet and rushed after him. Berlin slowed to a walk as he rounded the corner in the corridor leading from cell house number one. He eared back the hammers on the shotgun and pointed it ahead of him as he walked toward a desk at the end of the corridor. Bob Colton, head guard, was sitting behind the desk, finishing his supper of fried chicken and mashed potatoes. He looked up and saw Ozark Jack Berlin stalking toward him with the double-barreled shotgun aimed at his gullet.
Howdy, Bob. How about you take that hog leg out of your holster and put it on the desk there?
Colton swallowed and gingerly pulled his pistol out of his holster, placed it on the desk in front of it.
Don't do nothing stupid, Ozark.
Stupid would be staying here to get hanged, Bob. Now, get to your feet. Walk on back into the cell back there. I'll spread your guts all over the wall.
Colton got up and walked down the corridor.
Sam, put him in the cellar with others and lock the doors.
Less than 30 minutes later, Berlin, Blue Owl, and the other 30 men were in the prison armory, where they had armed themselves with pistols, shotguns, and rifles, and were stuffing their pockets with boxes of ammunition. Two other guards who happened upon the group were stripped of their weapons and placed in the cell house with the others. The prisoners then made their way to the stables, saddled up 10 horses, hitched up a couple of teams to two supply wagons, and raced out of the prison gates. As the escapees rode down the trail away from the town of Sugar House toward the mountains in the distance, Blue Owl inclined his head toward the men riding in the wagons.
We ain't gonna make much time with them wagons, Ozark. What are we gonna do?
Well, there's plenty of farms between here and the high country. We'll just stop along the way and take what horses and supplies we need. After all, who's gonna stop us?
Warden Joshua M. Stevens came out of a sound sleep with his heart hammering as someone pounded on his door. He slowly crept out of his bed. On the way to answer the door, Stevens paused to pick up a Colt off a dining room sideboard. Being the warden of a prison that housed hundreds of desperados made a man cautious, especially when awakened in the middle of the night.
Who is it?
It's Brock Jackson, warden.
Brock was the assistant warden, Stevens' second in command at the prison. Stevens eased the hammer down on the Colt and opened the door.
What the hell are you doing here at this ungodly hour?
Jackson twirled his hat in his hand nervously as he entered the warden's drawing room.
There's been a prison break, Josh.
Anyone injured?
One of the guards, Joe Johnson, was killed. Another, Billy Thornton, was knocked unconscious, but he's recovering.
Tell me what happened while I boil some coffee.
Stevens walked toward the kitchen. After a fire was lit in the stove, the two men sat at the kitchen table.
Ozark Jack Berlin and that breed Blue Owl killed Johnson. And when Thornton went in to help, they knocked him out and took his weapons. After that, they got the drop on the other night shift guards, broke into the armory and stole some weapons and ammunition. Then took the horses and wagons out of the stable and hightailed it towards the mountains.
How many got out?
Over 30, all from cell house number one.
Oh, damn. Those are the worst men we've got.
You're right about that, Josh. There ain't a one of them that wouldn't cut the throat of a baby if it meant they'd go free.
Anybody told Mrs. Johnson about Joe yet?
I sent one of the guards, who's a good friend, over to break the news to her.
Well, I'll get dressed and head on over to the telegraph office. I've got to notify the governor as soon as it's light.
What do you want me to do?
We don't have enough men to go chasing them, not and still guard the prison. You better get over to the army post and see if they'll send a patrol out after them.
Yes, sir.
And Brock.
Yeah?
Tell the captain over there to send plenty of good men. Let him know what kind of bad men they'll be going up against.
Yes, sir.
10 miles east of Salt Lake City, Ozark Jack Berlin held up his hand as his men crested a small ridge looking down on a valley below. Sun was just peeking over the horizon, sending bright orange and red rays over the farm below. There was a main house, a large barn, and off to one side a bunkhouse. In a corral next to the barn, about 15 horses could be seen.
Looks like just what we need, boys. Yeah!
His men pulled out their weapons and leaned over their horses as Berlin led the charge down the side of the hill. As they galloped down the slope, a man and a woman appeared on the porch of the house. The man never stood a chance. The woman disappeared back inside. Men came streaming out of the bunkhouse, only to be cut down by the outlaws' withering fire. The battle was over in seconds. Berlin pointed to the corral and barn.
Get them horses saddled and see what else you can find in the barn and bunkhouse. We need some clothes and supplies, and don't forget to get their guns and ammunition before we leave.
Blue Owl cut his eyes toward the house where the woman had disappeared.
You go ahead, boss. I got me some business in the house.
Yeah, save a little for the rest of us, Blue Owl. Don't cut her up till we get our turn.
But Ozark, that's half the fun.
You can cut her when the rest of us are done. But it's been a long time since most of us have had a woman, so take it easy.
Blue Owl nodded as he turned his horse's head toward the house. Later, Berlin took stock of what they'd found. Most of the men were able to get out of their prison coveralls and into jeans and shirts, though some were too big to fit into the clothes of the farmer and his hands. They also found enough horses in the corral and barn to get all of the men on horseback and off the wagons, along with more guns, rifles, shotguns, and even some dynamite the farmer used to bust up tree stumps. All of the food was taken from the house. Then, with the farmer's wife's body still lying on the bed in their bedroom, Berlin put a torch to the house. As they walked their horses toward the distant mountains, Berlin smiled.
A couple more farms like this and we should have enough supplies and horses to get us through the mountains into Colorado.
It'll be hard going if the snows come early.
Not as hard as going the other way. I suspect Army will be on our trail by now.
They try to follow us up into the high country. It'll be easy to ambush them.
Well, that's what I figured. If we can kill enough of them, they'll soon tire of chasing us.
Army Captain Wallace Bickford looked across his desk at Brock Jackson.
Are you telling me 30 of the worst criminals in your prison just walked out last night?
Yeah, Captain. Only they didn't just walk out. They killed one guard and smashed another's head in. Like I told you, these men are all killers. About as bad as men can be. If we don't do something soon, they're going to leave a trail of blood behind them that'll make newspapers all over the country.
Mr. Jackson, I want to be honest with you. I just got a batch of fresh recruits here. Not only have these boys not seen any action yet, I'm just not sure they're up to a job like this.
Captain, ready or not, the Army took them in and made them soldiers. Now they got a job to do, and I'm afraid there isn't anyone else available to do it.
Maybe it'll be all right if I send them out with a couple of sergeants who've been around for a while.
Good. But, Captain, be sure and send plenty of men. If I'm right, there are going to be quite a few who don't come back.
That's what I'm afraid of, Mr. Jackson.
I'll be sure and tell the governor how cooperative you've been.
Yeah. Maybe he'll be so grateful he'll write the letters to the families of the boys who don't come back.
Smoke Jensen pushed the bat wings to Lewis Longmont's saloon open and stepped inside. Out of long habit, he stood to the side of the door, his back to the wall, until his eyes had adjusted to the relative gloom of the establishment. Cal and Pearlie followed him inside and did the same on the other side of the door, hands near their Colts until they were sure there was no danger waiting inside. Such were the actions that years of standing by the side of one of the most famous gunfighters in the West had taught him. Louis Longmont, owner of the saloon, looked up from his usual table in a far corner and smiled over his coffee. Smoke from the long black cigar in his hand swirling around his head, stirred by a gentle breeze from the open windows in the walls.
Smoke, boys, come on in.
As they approached, Longmont's eyes drifted to Smoke's waist. Then his eyebrows raised in surprise. He noted Smoke was not wearing his usual brace of pistols on his belt. He looked up at his friend walking toward him, noticing again his imposing stature. Standing a couple of inches over 6 feet, with wide, muscular shoulders and a narrow waist, wearing his trademark buckskins, Smoke still looked dangerous, even though he was unarmed. Louis, an ex-gunfighter himself, couldn't imagine what had made Smoke leave his ranch at the Sugarloaf, a few miles north of the town of Big Rock, without wearing his pistols. Louis was a lean, hawk-faced man, with strong, slender hands and long fingers, nails carefully manicured, hands clean. He had jet black hair and a black pencil-thin mustache. He was, as usual, dressed in a black suit with white shirt and dark ascot, something he'd picked up on a trip to England some years back. He wore low-heeled boots and a pistol hung in tied-down leather on his right side. It was not for show, for Louis was snake-quick with a short gun and was a feared, deadly gun hand when pushed. Louis was not an evil man. He had never hired his gun out for money. And while he could make a deck of cards do almost anything, he did not cheat at poker. He didn't have to cheat. He was possessed of a phenomenal memory and could tell you the odds of filling any type of poker hand, and was one of the first to use the new method of card counting. He was just past 40 years of age. He'd come to the West as a small boy with his parents, arriving from Louisiana. His parents had died in a shantytown fire, leaving the boy to cope as best he could. Welp, he had coped quite well, plying his innate intelligence and willingness to take a chance into a fortune. In addition to the saloon in Big Rock, he owned a large ranch up in Wyoming Territory, several businesses in San Francisco, and a hefty chunk of a railroad. As Smoke and Cal and Pearly took their seats at his table, Louis smiled casually.
You gents want some breakfast?
Pearly was never one to turn down food.
Well, I thought you'd never ask. Eggs, bacon, pancakes, and some of those fried potatoes Andre's famous for.
Dang, Pearly, we ate once this morning already.
Well, that was hours ago, Cal. And it was a long ride from the Sugarloaf.
All right, boys. Louis, would you ask Andre to bring us all some eggs and bacon and coffee?
Andre, we got some hungry cowboys out here. Fix them something special.
Andre, Louis's French chef and friend of many years, stuck his head out the small window, saw Smoke and the boys, grinned, and nodded. He loved cooking for them, especially Pearly, who was lavish in his praise of the chef's cuisine. The waiter brought cups and a fresh pot of coffee and poured it all around. Once the men were drinking, Louis stared at Smoke and inclined his head toward his friend.
I notice you're only half-dressed this morning. Any particular reason?
Well, after that last little fracas when Sally had to dig 2 bullets out of my hide, she sat me down for a long talk.
And?
The upshot of it was, I'm not getting any younger. She thinks I'm too old to go traipsing around fighting every saddle tramp and would-be famous gunslinger who wants to make a name for himself by shooting Smoke Jensen.
And her solution for this deplorable situation?
She said if I quit wearing my guns, there would be less chance of my getting shot.
Typical woman's thinking. And what if by chance some gunny braces you anyway?
I'm supposed to let Cal and Pearly show them the error of their ways while I stay out of it.
Smoke, old friend, you know I respect Sally more than any other woman I've ever met. But she's dead wrong this time. Taking your guns away from you is like taking the fangs off a rattlesnake and thinking it'll lie down with the rabbits.
Well, I agree with you, Louis. In fact, I'm going to take you out to the Sugarloaf and have you tell that to Sally.
Oh, no, Smoke. I'd face down a gang of cutthroats for you, stand with you against a band of bloodthirsty Indians, but I wouldn't have the nerve to face up to Sally when she's in a protect-my-man stance. She'd tear me apart.
The conversation was halted when Andre and the waiter appeared bearing platters heaped with scrambled eggs, layers of steaming bacon, fresh-cut tomatoes, and fried potatoes.
Andre, you have to be my favoritest person in this whole dang town. Sorry, Smoke.
Andre smiled and went back to the kitchen while the men dug into their meals. The men quickly finished, and they were enjoying after-breakfast coffee and cigarettes when the Batwing swung open and four men walked in. They stood in the doorway, brushing trail dust off their clothes for a moment before proceeding toward the bar. Smoke's eyes took in their garb. Two of the men were dressed mostly in black, with shiny boots, vests adorned with silver conchos, and pistols worn low on their right hips. They appeared to be related, bearing a strong resemblance to each other, and both looked to be in their early 20s. The men with them were more nondescript, wearing flannel shirts, trail coats, and chaps. They also wore their pistols in the manner of gunmen, rather than trail hands.
Give us a bottle of whiskey.
Uh-oh. Looks like trouble.
Smoke glanced at the regulator clock on the wall, which showed it to be 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it's awfully early to be drinking liquor.
As the men downed their shots, one glanced over and noticed Lewis and Smoke looking at him. He frowned, put his glass down, and sauntered over toward him.
Hey, mister, you look familiar, like I seen you someplace before.
I've been someplace before.
The man's face looked puzzled as he tried to figure out if Smoke was making fun of him for a moment. Then he scowled.
I got it! You're Smoke Jensen!
Congratulations.
The man glanced over his shoulder as if to see if his friends were watching.
My friends and me traveled a long way to find you.
And just who might you be?
My name's Tucson.
You must be from Arizona.
Well, how the hell do you know that?
A lucky guess.
I'm afraid you're out of luck, Tucson. I'm not hiring anyone at the ranch just now.
I didn't come looking for work, Jensen.
Then why did you come?
I came to kill you.
Any particular reason?
Yeah, a few years back, you killed my cousin.
What was your cousin's name?
Billy Walker.
And where did this happen?
He came up here from Texas. Billy rode with a man named Lazarus Cain.
Ah, now I remember. Cain was a crazy Bible thumper who thought God was protecting him. Turned out he was wrong.
Well, Billy were crazy. You gut shot him and left him to die.
If he rode with Cain, he deserved to die.
Stand up and face me like a man, Jensen.
Pearly and Cal got to their feet. Pearly took the rawhide hammer thong off his colt and stood off to the side, as did Cal.
Settle down, mister. As you can see, Mr. Jensen ain't wearing no guns.
Why ain't he healed? He afraid to die?
Nope. Just the Smoke's might tired of killing scum like you, fella. You see, he's done killed a couple hundred or more, and he's getting sick of it. Now me, I ain't killed near that many, so it don't bother me none if you want to try your hand.
As Pearly spoke, Tucson's friends edged away from the bar to stand next to him, their hands near their weapons.
4-2, Pearly. That ought to make it about fair.
Lewis stood up, sweeping his black coat behind his back, exposing his pistol.
4-3, Cal.
Hold on just a minute. I'm not used to letting other people fight my battles for me.
Smoke stepped over to stand just inches from Tucson.
You think you're pretty fast with that hog leg, son?
Fast enough to beat you, old man.
Then go for it. If you can get it out and fire before I take it away from you and stick it up your ass, then you'll have your revenge.
But you ain't got no gun.
I don't need a gun to beat a pup like you, Tucson. Grab leather.
Tucson's hand went for his gun. Before he had it half out of his holster, Smoke's left hand moved quicker than the eye could follow. He grabbed Tucson's right hand where it was holding the handle of the pistol and he squeezed. At the sound of their friend's screams, the men behind him went for their guns. They never had a chance against the likes of Cal, Pearly, and Lewis.
Oh my gosh, darn!
That could be you lying there, spilling your guts all over the floor, boy. Now get on your horse and ride off while you still can.
Without another word, Tucson ran out the door. Smoke looked at the dead bodies lying on the floor.
What a waste.
Meanwhile, Lewis stared at Cal and Pearly.
I'd never have believed it.
Believed what?
You boys almost beat me to the draw.
What do you mean, almost?
Ozark Jack Berlin and his men slowed their horses as they approached the outskirts of a small mining town named Lode in the mountains east of Salt Lake City. Berlin glanced at Blue Owl, riding next to him.
Tell the men to ride with their guns loose.
You expecting trouble from these desert rat miners?
You never know, Blue Owl. These men have been working for years to pull silver out of those mountains, and they're liable to not take kindly to anybody who tries to take it away from them.
Blue Owl nodded and jerked the head of his horse around to pass the word among the men riding behind him. As they rode down the muddy center of the town, the men looked around. The town consisted mainly of tent buildings, some with wooden storefronts and tents on the rear. The businesses consisted mostly of brothels and saloons, with a couple of small general stores selling food and mining equipment. There didn't seem to be a jail or sheriff's office, which caused Berlin to feel a little better about the town. When they came abreast of what appeared to be the largest saloon, Berlin pulled his horse to a stop. He dismounted and tied the animal to a rail as his men gathered around.
We're gonna go in here and have a few drinks to clear the trail dust out of our throats. But I'll shoot the first man who causes any trouble or brings attention to us. Understand?
The men sobered and nodded and followed Berlin into the saloon. The room was a very large tent with what appeared to be handmade tables and chairs scattered around the dirt floor. The bar consisted of two 12-inch wide boards placed across a couple of sawhorses. That sat in front of a wooden wall holding hundreds of bottles of whiskey, most without labels on them. It being early in the day, about 10 in the morning, the place was largely unoccupied, with only 10 or 12 men sitting at various tables. Berlin walked to the bar. The bartender glanced around at the 30 men crowding into the space near the bar, and he smiled in anticipation of a very profitable morning trade.
What'll it be, gents?
Give us four bottles of your best whiskey and some glasses.
But them bottles are $20 apiece.
Berlin reached in his pocket and pulled out a handful of gold coins. Tossed them negligently on the bar.
Yes, sir.
The barman put the bottles and a tray of small shot glasses on the bar.
Let's find some tables.
Once he was seated at a table with Blue Owl and Sam Cook, Berlin leaned forward.
We gotta make a choice, Ozark.
Yeah?
Once word gets out about the jailbreak, there are gonna be lawmen all over the state looking for us. Traveling with 30 men makes us stand out like a sore thumb.
And just what do you think we ought to do about it?
If we want to disappear, get away clean, it'd be better if we took off on our own.
And then what, Blue Owl? Get us a job punching cattle or digging holes in the ground looking for ore?
We could rob us some banks or hold up some stages.
Penny ante stuff. Look at what we got here, Blue Owl. We got us a ready-made gang here. 30 of the meanest, most bloodthirsty men in Utah. Ain't nobody can stand against us. We can ride into towns, take what we want, and nobody can do nothing about it.
Forgetting about the army, Ozark, I figure it won't be long before they're on our trail.
Now, that's where we got the real advantage, Blue Owl. The army has to wait for orders before they can do anything. If we keep moving, crossing state and territorial lines, the army ain't never gonna catch up to us.
What if they do?
And we blow them out of their saddles, just like we do anybody else who tries to cross us.
If we're gonna go up against the Bluecoats, Ozark, we're gonna need more guns.
And that brings us to my next plan.
After they finished off the whiskey, Berlin and his men got on their horses and rode down the street until they came to the livery stable. Berlin and Blue Owl went inside. An old man with a gray beard was using a pitchfork to throw hay into stalls for the animals inside.
You the owner?
Yep.
You got any mules?
I got four, but they ain't for sale. I can rent them to you for a day or two, though.
That ain't good enough, old-timer.
Berlin motioned for Blue Owl to gather up the mules and lead them outside. They took the mules and rode back down the street toward a large general store in the middle of town. Berlin and Blue Owl, followed by the rest of the men, went inside. They began to pile up supplies, beans, bacon, flour, sugar, and jerk meat on the counter, waiting until the other customers had finished and left the building. Berlin nodded at Blue Owl, who walked to the door, pulled the shade, and turned the sign on the door around until it said, "Closed."
"Hey, what the hell you think you're doing?"
Sam Cook, without saying a word, drew his pistol and slammed the barrel down on the store owner's head. As Cook dragged him by his boots back behind the counter, the rest of the men proceeded to load all of the supplies on the mules, taking additional clothing and stuffing it in their saddlebags. Berlin and Blue Owl walked to the back wall of the store. There were over 20 rifles, assorted handguns, and boxes of ammunition stacked there. Berlin began to hand the guns out to the men, along with the ammunition.
"Blue Owl, take some of those boxes of dynamite and fuses along, too. We might need them if the army gets too close."
In less than half an hour, the mules were loaded down with boxes and canvas bags of supplies, including several boxes of dynamite and two cans of gunpowder. Meanwhile, Berlin had gone to have a talk with the local assayer. Then he returned to the store. He was the last to leave. He shut the door, leaving the sign on it saying that the store was closed for the day. He mounted up and waved his hand.
"Let's ride, man. We're burning daylight."
"What about the horse?"
"There'll be other towns, Billy."
"Yeah!"
Lieutenant Jonathan Pike held up his hand to the 40 troops riding behind him. They were in the main street of Lode, and he could see a crowd of miners and prostitutes gathered around the general store. Sergeant Bob Guthrie looked grim.
"What do you make of it, Lieutenant?"
"I don't know. Keep the men here and I'll ride up and see what all the commotion is about."
"And do you think we could let the men get a drink or two in that saloon over there, sir? It's been a long, dusty ride."
"Yeah, Sarge, but beer only. No whiskey. We happen to run into those escaped prisoners. I don't want any drunk men doing my fighting for me."
"Yes, sir."
Guthrie got the men organized and into the saloon. Pike walked his horse toward the crowd up ahead. He dismounted and approached a man who seemed to be in control.
"Excuse me, sir. I'm Lieutenant Pike with the Army. May I ask what's going on here?"
"Howdy, Lieutenant. My name's Wilson Smith, and I guess you could say I'm the mayor of this here town. About 4 hours ago, we had a group of 20 or 30 men ride in through here. They killed the livery owner, slit his throat clear through, and they knocked out the owner of the general store. Doc's in there stitching up his head now."
"Why'd they kill the livery owner?"
"Well, to get his mules, I guess. They're about the only thing we can find that's missing down there."
"Mules? Why would they need mules?"
"Why, to haul off all the stuff they took from the general store, I guess."
"Excuse me, Mayor. I'm gonna go inside and talk to the owner."
"Best be careful, Lieutenant. He ain't in too good a mood."
Pike nodded and stepped through the door. He found an elderly man in a black coat and white shirt leaning over the counter, upon which lay another man with blood on his face and shirt. Pike walked up.
"Gentlemen, my name is Lieutenant Jonathan Pike. Could you tell me what they took?"
"Damn near everything that wasn't nailed down, Lieutenant, that's what. Clothes, food, rifles and pistols, ammunition, and even some dynamite and gunpowder."
"Damn. About how long ago did they leave?"
"Oh, how the hell do I know? I was stretched out dead to the world."
The doctor glanced over his shoulder at Pike.
"Best we can tell, it was about 4 hours ago."
Pike glanced at his watch. It was now almost 3:30 in the afternoon. It would be dark long before they could catch up to the escapees, and he did not relish coming upon them in the dark.
"Is there any place in town I can billet my men till tomorrow?"
"You going after those bastards?"
"Yes, sir, but I want to track them in daylight, not at night."
As the doctor leaned back, finished with his sewing, the owner sat up.
"Oh, I'm Josh Cowlins. I own one of the houses down the street. It's got a sign on the front that reads Pleasure Palace. Now, it ain't really no palace, but it's got enough beds and couches in it so your men can get out of the weather.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. I'll give you a voucher so you can send your bill to the army.
Now, I don't need no voucher. Long as you get the sons of bitches that did this to me, I'll call it square.
That's what the army's paying us to do, Mr. Collins.
Cal glanced at Pearlie as they rode back with Smoke toward the sugar loaf. He raised his eyebrows, wondering if he should say anything. Smoke had been uncharacteristically quiet on the return trip, not laughing and joking as he usually did on these excursions to town. Pearlie returned Cal's look, shrugging. He too was unused to Smoke's quiet mood. Cal considered his options. He'd been more than an employee of Smoke's for several years. In fact, both Smoke and his wife Sally looked upon Cal as more of a son than a hired hand. Cal had come to work at the Sugarloaf while just a boy in his teens. He'd been on his own, penniless and starving, and had actually tried to hold up Sally one morning while she was on her way into town to buy supplies. After he drew down on Sally and asked her for some food, she got the drop on him with the snub-nosed 36 caliber pistol she carried in her purse. Cal laughed and showed her that the ancient pistol he was pointing at her was unloaded anyway. Realizing the boy was starving, Sally took him to the Sugarloaf and offered him a job. He'd been part of the family ever since.
Smoke?
Yeah.
Been awfully quiet this trip. Anything wrong?
So you noticed.
Hell yes.
It's just that I'm not used to relying on someone else to pull my fat out of the fire.
What do you mean?
I feel naked without my Colts. After more years than I care to remember with them at my sides, it just doesn't feel right not to be wearing them.
Why don't you try talking to Sally about it, Smoke? She's usually reasonable about these things.
You ever try talking a woman out of something when she's got her mind set on it, Cal?
Matter of fact, I ain't had a whole lot of experience with women at all, Smoke.
Keep it that way, Cal. And you'll have a whole lot less gray hair when you get to be my age.
You could just put the guns back on and tell Sally that's the way it's gonna be.
I could, but the problem with that is it would make Sally very unhappy. And since I love her, her unhappiness would make me unhappy too.
Love is a bitch, ain't it?
It sure can be sometimes. Other times, it's the greatest feeling in the world.
Sally Jensen walked out on the porch of their cabin when she heard Smoke's and the boys' horses arrive.
Not a word about what happened in town.
Are you men hungry?
Now, Miss Sally, what kind of a question is that? You ever know Pearlie to admit he wasn't hungry? The man's stomach is a bottomless pit.
We had breakfast at Lewis's.
Then I guess you didn't leave room for any bear sign.
Bear sign?
I made a couple dozen, but since you've already eaten...
Out of my way, Smoke. I can hear them bear sign calling my name.
As the boys sat down to eat, Sally poured them all mugs of rich, dark coffee. She leaned down to put the mugs on the table.
You boys smell like gunpowder. Anything happen in town I ought to know about?
Cal and Pearlie glanced at each other, then at Smoke, waiting for him to answer. Smoke paused, a bear sign halfway to his mouth. He pursed his lips as if considering how he should respond.
I know when all of you get lockjaw at the same time, that means something must have happened while you were in town.
Smoke laid the bear sign down and leaned back in his chair, staring at Sally.
You're right, as usual, dear.
Come on, give.
While we were eating breakfast at Lewis's, we were braced by three young gunnies looking to make a reputation for themselves.
Didn't they see that you weren't wearing any weapons?
Didn't make no difference to that kind of men, Miss Sally. Once they knew who Smoke was, they was bound and determined to egg him into a gunfight.
And what did you do, Smoke?
What could I do, Sally? I wasn't wearing any guns at your request.
So why do I smell gunpowder on you all?
Because when those gun slicks drew on me, Cal and Pearlie saved my bacon by drawing and shooting them before they could kill me.
Thanks, boys.
Smoke threw his napkin down on the table and stood up, his face angry.
And I'll tell you something else, Sally. It's gonna happen again. Sooner or later, long as you insist on me not wearing any guns. I'm gonna ride out and take a look at the herd.
Cal and Pearlie, embarrassed to be present at this scene of domestic disturbance, kept their heads down as they ate a bear sign and tried to pretend they hadn't heard anything. Sally walked around the table and sat down at Smoke's seat. She stared at Cal and Pearlie.
You boys think I'm wrong in asking Smoke not to wear his Colts?
Now, we know it's because you love Smoke and don't want him to get shot no more, Miss Sally. But you've been out here in the West long enough to know that don't make no difference to the kind of men who come looking to make a reputation by killing the famous Smoke Jensen.
Pearlie's right, Miss Sally. Making Smoke go without his guns ain't gonna keep him safe. It's more than likely you're gonna get him killed.
Sally looked out the window, tears in her eyes, as she thought over what they'd said. After a few moments, she nodded to herself and got up.
You boys finish the bear sign.
Sally walked to the door and took Smoke's gun belt off the peg in the wall where it had hung since she'd asked him not to wear it anymore. She hung it over her shoulder and walked out the door toward her horse, reined in at the hitching post in front of the cabin.
Finally, she's showing some sense.
Smoke was sitting on his horse, hands crossed over the pommel, looking out over the herd of cattle in the valley below, when Sally rode up, reining in beside him. When he glanced over at her, she took the gun belt off her shoulder and handed it to him.
Here.
What's this?
Take it, please, Smoke. The only reason I asked you not to wear it anymore was I was getting tired of either taking bullets out of you myself or standing around while Doc Morrow did it.
Smoke took the belt and slipped it around his waist, buckling it up.
You sure this is what you want?
Smoke, the only thing I want is for the man I love to stay alive. I don't look good in widow's black.
I promise you. I'll be extra careful, Sally.
Sally looked around at the lush green grass and the maple and birch trees that were just beginning to come alive with the colors of fall.
You suppose we might get down off these horses and sit under that maple tree over there and talk about it for a while?
If we get down off these horses, I have a feeling we're going to be doing a whole lot more than talking.
Sally swung down out of the saddle, unhitched the belly strap, and let her saddle fall to the ground. She took the saddle blanket off the horse, hung it over her arm, and walked toward the nearest tree, looking back over her shoulder with an unmistakable invitation in her eyes. As the dawn peeked over mountaintops to the east, Lieutenant Jonathan Pike knocked on Sergeant Bob Guthrie's door at the Pleasure Palace.
Yes, sir?
Pike glanced over Guthrie's shoulder. He saw a large thatch of red hair sticking out from under the covers and an empty bottle of whiskey lying on its side on its bedside table.
Sun's up, Sergeant. We're burning daylight.
Yes, sir. I'll get myself presentable and muster the men soon as I can.
I'll wait for you in the dining room, Sergeant, and I'll have breakfast waiting for you, so no further delays.
Yes, sir. I'll get right on it.
Afraid your eggs are cold, Sergeant.
I've been in the Army nigh on 20 years, Lieutenant. I'm used to bad food, long days, and cold nights.
I trust last night wasn't too cold for you, Bob?
No, sir. Last night, the temperature was right tolerable.
Good, because it's liable to be the last warm night we spend for quite some time. The outlaws headed up into the high country, and I intend to follow them till we catch every last one of the scoundrels.
You think that's wise, sir? It's not going to be an easy campaign following those galoots up into the mountains.
What do you mean?
Well, number one, they're going to know we're coming after them. And if they're at all smart, they're going to have someone watching their back trail. Once they find out we're on their trail, it'll be an easy matter for them to set an ambush where they'll have the high ground.
So, you think we should just let them go on their way after all they've done?
Not exactly, sir, but they ain't going to do no one any harm up in those mountains. Especially with winter just around the corner. It's my guess they'll soon get tired of wandering around up to their asses in snow and freezing their butts off and come down to civilization. If we check the map, we can find out where they're liable to come down and have someone waiting for them when they do.
No, Sergeant, I don't relish just giving up the hunt. Captain Bickford assigned me to track these criminals down and bring them to justice, and I intend to follow my orders.
Even if it means getting half our men killed?
My men didn't sign up in the Army for easy duty, Sergeant. And I think you overestimate the fighting ability of our foes. After all, these men we're tracking are ordinary killers.
not military geniuses. I think when they see the number of men after them, they'll more than likely give up without a fight.
Guthrie just clenched his jaw and went back to his breakfast, knowing it was no use arguing with an officer who had his head up his butt. He knew the men from the prison wouldn't just give up, and he also knew that before this campaign was over, there was going to be blood on the snow of the High Lonesome. Ozark Jack Berlin crawled out of his sleeping bag and stood up, checking the weather. The wind was blowing out of the north, carrying with it small particles of ice and snow and chilling him to the bone. The night before, he'd made a camp for his men in the shelter of a group of boulders piled against the steep side of a mountain ledge. The fire they'd built was nothing but coals now, and was giving off little heat to combat the frigid cold of the north wind. Berlin stepped over to Blue Owl's sleeping bag and nudged the sleeping figure of the Indian with his foot.
Blue Owl, get your ass out of bed and get the men moving. We need a fire and some coffee before we freeze to death.
As Blue Owl stirred, trying to come awake, Berlin made the rounds of the other men, kicking him awake and telling him to get up and get ready to travel. By the time he'd finished, Blue Owl had the fire going and several pots of coffee cooking on the coals. Billy Bartlett and Moses Johnson, a black man who'd killed a farmer and his family when they'd refused him work, were filling skillets with eggs and slabs of fatback bacon, while kettles of pinto beans bubbled and boiled on iron trestles over the flames. Soon, 30 men were gathered as close to the warmth of the fire as they could get, drinking steaming coffee from tin mugs and wolfing down eggs, bacon, and beans as if they hadn't eaten in weeks. Blue Owl, his shoulders hunched inside a buffalo robe he'd taken from town, held his coffee mug in both hands to keep him warm and glanced up at Berlin, who was standing next to him smoking a cigarette, staring at the mountains to the east.
Yo, boss, what are your plans for today?
Several of the gunmen who were sitting nearby looked up, waiting for what Berlin had to say.
We ain't got no choice but to head eastward. We got a town full of angry miners and half the goddamn army behind us, so I guess we'll just keep on moving east.
If we keep going east, that means we gotta climb higher up in those mountains, and it's gonna get colder up in there. We got us a big norther blowing in, and this is just the beginning of the bad weather we're going to face if we go any higher up into the mountains.
I'm open to suggestions, Blue Owl. If you've gotten any better ideas, now's the time to give them.
I think we ought to head on back down the mountain. We got more than enough men and guns to fight off the army.
And then what?
Then we could head south, skirting the mountains, till we come to a pass somewheres where we don't have to go up into snow country.
Uh-huh.
Well, what's wrong with that plan?
Just about everything. First off, you want to engage the army in a fight on level ground with these men? And then you might be brave enough, but they aren't exactly trained in fighting on horseback against men who are. Secondly, assuming we could win against the army and the miners from the town we just passed through, by the time we'd travel 50 miles, somebody would have telegraphed ahead and there'd be another group of army men or lawmen or bounty hunters waiting for us.
So, what's different about your plan?
First off, while we make our way up into the mountains, we're going to station some men on our back trail to warn us if the army tries to come after us. If they do, then we'll fix up a nice little surprise for them that'll take them out without getting half our men killed.
What about the telegraph you're so worried about? The miners in the town back yonder can still telegraph ahead and have people waiting for us.
No, they can't. By the time they figure out the army's failed, they won't know which way we're headed. Once we reach the pass at the top of the mountain, we can go north, east, or south, and nobody's gonna know which way we've gone.
What about the weather?
Berlin nodded to Billy Bartlett.
Well, I'll admit it's gonna get a mite cold. We got plenty of supplies, and we'll be able to get more from the soldiers we kill if and they come after us. With any luck, we'll only be up here for a week or so. Then we can head back down the other side of the mountains to warmer weather.
A large, barrel-chested man with a thick beard stood up from the other side of the fire.
You got a question, Mac?
Yeah, I want to know who made you the boss. I don't recall no election.
You got an objection to me calling the shots, Mac?
Yeah, you ain't got no right to be...
Berlin looked around at the men gathered around him, his smoking pistol still in his hand.
Now, you men got to make a choice. This ain't the army, and it ain't prison. Any of you wants to can go your own way, and there'll be no hard feelings.
Blue Owl glanced over at the body of Mac on the ground.
Yeah, boss, I can see that.
No, I mean it. Any of you who want to can leave. But those of you who stay have got to know who's running things around here. If you stay, you're gonna do things my way, or you can do like Mac and take your chances that you're faster with the gun than I am. Any questions?
The men all shook their heads and went back to eating their breakfast and drinking their coffee, some glancing nervously at Mac's body lying nearby. Lieutenant Jonathan Pike sat on his horse at the head of his column of men as they prepared to ride out of Load, Utah on the trail of the escaped prisoners. Mayor Wilson Smith stood nearby, watching as the men readied their mounts.
Mayor?
Yes, sir, Lieutenant.
I need you to do me a favor.
Whatever you need, Lieutenant.
Would you send some telegraphs for me?
Sure. Where to?
I'd like you to notify Fort Collins in Denver in Colorado and the sheriff's office in Cheyenne, Wyoming, what's happened here the past couple of days. If for some reason those criminals get by us in the mountains, they've got to either turn north to Wyoming or south toward Colorado. I'd like the authorities to be aware that they may have to take action if we fail to stop them.
I'll take care of it, Lieutenant. You got my word.
Sergeant Guthrie walked his horse up next to Pike's.
Now there's one other thing, Mayor.
What's that, Sergeant?
If worse comes to worse and we lose this battle, there's a small chance those men may head back down this way. If I were you, I'd make sure the town was ready for them if they decide to backtrack down here.
Oh, we'll be ready for them, Sergeant. They won't get another chance to raid this town.
Guthrie nodded, glanced at Pike, and waved his hand to the men in the column behind him.
Forward! Hope!
Jesus Santiago squatted next to a small fire on a bluff overlooking a winding trail up the mountainside. The fire was set back from the edge of the cliff among stunted pines, its smoke whipped into nothingness by the strong winds coming from the north. Santiago slapped his hands on his arms, then held his hands in front of the flames, trying to get some warmth from the fire.
God almighty, I'm freezing my ass off up here.
Wiley Gottlieb walked from the ledge, where he'd been looking along the path through binoculars, and he took a small bottle of whiskey from his saddlebags. He pulled the cork and took a long drink, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
Ozark Jack Berlin is crazy if he thinks the army's going to be fool enough to follow us up here in this blizzard.
Santiago glanced up at heavy, dark clouds through swirls of snow and particles of ice slanting with the wind.
You think this is a blizzard, Wiley? Hell, this is nothing but a little fall storm. Just wait till we get to the high country. Then you'll see what a real blizzard looks like.
If it gets any colder than this, I may just take Ozark up on his offer to hightail my ass down the mountain.
Gottlieb walked back over to the edge of the overlook. Put the glasses to his eyes and pointed them back down the trail. Santiago had begun to stir the coals, trying to coax more heat from the fire.
Jesus! I'll be goddamned!
Santiago jumped up and ran to stand next to Gottlieb, staring in the direction of his binoculars. He could see through the mist and snow and sleet, a line of shadowy figures on horseback winding their way up the trail in the distance, their blue and gold uniforms clearly visible through the gloom.
How many you make it?
I can't tell for sure, but it looks to be 50 or more.
Damn, Ozark was right. We got to get going and warn the others.